your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and my gosh, we've had a hell of the care bill that was trying to be pushed through Congress met a retraction. I mean, well, pull it, you know? I mean, what was that all about? Paul Ryan is not providing the leadership that he needs to as Speaker of the House. Whenever you're Speaker of the House, you still have to secure a consensus between the Democrats and the Republicans. You don't go and promulgate some kind of a bill behind closed doors with a few insiders, even within the Republicans, and not disclose it fully to all the members of Congress. You've got to employ certain fair-minded type of approach to dealing with the adversaries like he has of the Democrats in Congress. No, he didn't do that. He kept it too secret. He put things in there too. Rand Paul spoke out on this matter earlier in the week, and he said, look, you don't put things in there where you're having citizens, Americans, pay insurance companies penalty fees. There were things like that were totally for the insurance companies and against the best interest of the American public. Now, President Trump made a basic mistake. And I'll tell you where he went wrong on this, is that the leadership that he should have, and the leadership that he should have provided would have been something that was much more measured and not trying to push through a bill that probably was not a very good bill to start with. It didn't have the support from the Republicans like it should have. Because it didn't have the support of the Republicans like it should have, then how could you sell it to Democrats? So it was half-hearted effort to push through something that was not wanted by several influential and important members of Congress. So it failed. They had to pull it before they reached an embarrassment of, hey, that's it. But also, President Trump made some basic errors by trying to threaten members of Congress that wouldn't vote for it if it had come to a vote. You're not going to get anywhere, President Trump, threatening Congress. This is not managing a corporation like you're used to, where you have a command structure and people work for you and take orders. This is a big monstrosity that's evolved over decades after decades of bureaucracies layered on one on top of another. So this is not a simple thing to approach or to manage. And also, you were right on your campaign trail, President Trump, in the sense that, yes, there is a lot of corruption. But I'm thinking you're finally realizing that there's a lot more corruption at a deeper level than I think you ever imagined even. So it's been entrenched. It's been created in there, and it's grown in there like a cancer. And it's just it's plundering and sucking the vitality and the creditworthiness and the financial worth of the nation. So you're on the right track of what to do, but you're not approaching it in a diplomatic way. Now, this ego thing that you have keeps rearing its ugly head. You've got to overcome that. But I don't know if you ever will. Your presidency, in my opinion, will revolve around being able to control your ego in the end. And if you can't really start controlling your ego by some method, I don't know if you'll ever realize this or not, then you're going to fail. Your presidency will fail. Battling the world is as much a battle with yourself as it is with these external so-called enemies. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "The battle line between good and evil runs through every human heart." And I think that's a very, very good statement and aphorism. Alexander Solzhenitsyn spent 9 years in Russian prison camps as a political prisoner. So who else would better know the problem of overcoming your own problems, your own demons, your own internal demons? We all have them. And that's the problem with this whole system of thinking and of rules. See, is that when I was in West Berlin working in the army on communications type of work, we would look across the wall and see these giant banners, okay, of these great giant personalities. And my colleagues back in the army were intercepting their phone calls, you know. And these big people, they had banners that were 30, 40, 50 feet tall, just streaming from these giant, you know, poles over there of these giant personages of great men of leadership. Yeah, communist leadership. And you look over there and it was drab. There wasn't any activity. People hardly had cars. There was no economic vitality, you could say. But this is what we're always up against, is that I've written extensively, and one thing that I've covered in the past is what I call the man problem. And the man problem, simply put, is that men have a propensity to default, to give in to their ego. And in doing that, they cannot ever overcome this ego state that they will need to. Very, very, you know, my gosh, it's just, this is turning in tonight, on the 25th of March, 2017. This is turning into something you might describe as a fireside chat. I want to sort of cover a lot of different things here. And this battleground, this civil war that's been, you could say, setting us up to ensue between the left and the right, the Democrats and the Republicans, is a false paradigm. The controllers that control the Democratic Party and those controllers that control the Republican Party, they're at the top. They're together. It's a money-based system of rule, okay, that has evolved. It came out of the Babylonian temple banking system. And, of course, men were the priests, you know. But they were also the bankers for the king. And so it started manipulating people through economic. The bankers began to be like the financiers between the consumer and the farmers of that day. And that's basically the same, you could say, interference and the subjugation that the banking system has visited on us. There's two arguments in the universe that I begin to look at to try to explain money on a physics basis. And it's what I call money physics. And Bob Chapman, I broached this with Bob Chapman years ago during our first interviews. And he said, "George, you got something. And you and I and J. Edward Griffin need to get together and talk about this." Well, I never really got together with J. Edward Griffin. But tonight I'm going to broach the idea a little bit and sort of visit our listening audience with it to sort of give you an indication. I wrote a book called Time Dynamism years ago, and I began to think in terms of field systems, but not only from a physics viewpoint. You know, any worthwhile, very knowledgeable physicist works with fields. He knows what when someone broaches the word fields with some physicists, they know what you're talking about. The field system that surrounds electromagnetic system, and there's air out there also. So I began to think about physics in a very broad way. And so I came up with three arguments. The store of space-time, the realization of space-time, and the third argument would be a redimensionalizing of space-time. Now, the redimensionalizing of space-time I threw away, and I said, hey, this is not something that we can personally experience because it's a black hole. So a black hole represents a redimensionalizing of space-time. The other two things we experience each and every day, and that would be the store of space-time and the realization of space-time. Now, the store of space-time is matter, okay? And the realization of space-time would be energy. See, and the fields surrounding us are experiencing a very energetic movement through space, you know. So I begin to apply those simple methods. I look back at classical economics and saw that land and labor were the principal means of production. And so I begin to say, okay, land is matter, so that's a store of space-time. And fields in the form of energy and work, okay, that's a realization of space-time. So you had the land and labor, and the labor itself would be the energy, the field systems of movement, see, of that gets things done. So I begin to apply this classical economics thing. I mated it up with some very simple ideas that physicists work in the fields of physics, you could say, each and every day. And I began to see that it's not as complicated as we first thought it might be. So what you do is you take land and you take labor and you put it together and you're going to create crops and value. You take constructing anything itself, you're going to have it made out of matter. And you put it together with your labor and you're going to produce an item and so forth. The banking and the capital aspect of it came in between the producer and the consumer. And that way they could regulate not only the what they wanted produced in any society, but they could also set the price. One overwhelming example of this would be in agriculture, and it had to do with commodity markets, okay? And Edward Mandel House's father, Edward Mandel House was the alternative alter ego of Woodrow Wilson. He also founded the CFR, and he also founded the Federal Reserve. So in Texas, the experience was that after the Civil War, the farmers out of Lampasas founded a Farmers Alliance. And this Farmers Alliance was created to try to distribute and sell their cotton. Cotton was king, see. But Edward Mandel House's father had another idea. He wanted to get a hold on the cotton market. He created a cotton brokerage company in Houston. And eventually, these farmers who had established a Farmers Alliance were totally wiped out by this industrial banking cartel out of Houston by way of Edward Mandel House. And then the son later would bring us, like I said, the Federal Reserve and other things. The money power is real. It's being used. The money power is taking over this country right now. This is the real danger. When you look at those that backed Hillary Clinton, you have to look at BlackRock. BlackRock manages assets of $4.5 trillion. Yes, my listening audience, that's with a big T, a capital T, not billion with a B. So the biggest money in the world was backing Hillary. They did lose. Now, Trump is an unknown. He's not going along with everything they want. He vanquished and he canceled out the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. This was a no-no in the New World Order, terms. So now Trump is sitting there, and they infiltrated his administration already. We know now that Obama had possible wiretaps on him, not wiretaps, but interceptions. That's beginning to come out now in the press. And so they knew who he was going to pick and choose, so they tried to control that somewhat. But they ran in a bunch of people, CFR members and, you know, New World Order types of members and the globalists that, you know, are being appointed left and right. So he's being surrounded, see. And he just doesn't have the staff either that is in tune with, I think, his goals that he had in mind originally. So when we talk about Trump today, number one, the ego state, he pops off too much. He needs to keep his mouth shut, and he needs to be very more deliberate and more reflective before he does make statements, whether it's on Twitter or whatever, say. But in his statements, then I know he can use this to troll this and troll that, but the overall effect sometimes is negative as far as the general public goes. He can easily be attacked, see, by these tweets and this and that, and then they can misconstrue it. And yes, he's coming out, he's being vindicated because there is evidence now that that they have been listening to him. But the problem with this is this. Men with Hill, a major interception site in Harrogate, England, that's operated by multiple intelligence operations, you could say, has been recording everything all over the world that they can get their hands on. So in America now, NSA has been, they're privy to about all of our phone calls, emails, and whatever, you know. So all they have to do is just start pulling out of their database, their storage, you know, about anybody. Now this is the danger. The NSA's mission used to be always foreign and not domestic. They have turned their operations, evidently, through different things, and it all centers around 9/11. 9/11 was an inside job. They took that and then they promulgated this act, that act, the home security, you know, all this other bureaucracies that are threatening to our liberties and freedoms. But in doing that, then they've turned these intelligence agencies inward on the American citizen. So the American citizen today is the enemy of the state. The deep state is attacking. This is the way to be able to see this. The deep state has on their side the Liberal Democratic Party and those people that were supporters of Hillary, and Hillary was supported by BlackRock that has $4.5 trillion. Do you get the current here, get the slant of this argument? And the city of London is right in the middle of this whole thing, see. So Trump is not going along. They're trying to rein him in. They've surrounded him with neocons and Council on Foreign Relations people. They're telling him, don't use that radical jihadist thing anymore, President Trump. It's not productive. This is basically what has happened. Trump is going to have to redo his staff. That's all there is to it. He needs to start looking at these staff members and saying, okay, you're fired, you stay, you're fired, you stay. He's got to really start doing what he did on The Apprentice, you know, like, hey, you're fired, hit the door, Jack, you know, and don't look back, you know. I don't know if this will happen. He's got to try to become more diplomatic in his approach to this thing called U.S. government, this federal bureaucracy that has sprung up. It's got all these committees. It's got these people are being lobbied every day by financial interests, international financial interests. They're being bought and paid for. They're being intimidated by the intelligence agencies with the blackmail because they did this, this, and that. They all have recordings of their worst sins, see? So it's dangerous, this country. The reason why I'm sort of speaking in a very frank way is that I care about this world, and I care about this country. America was a bright, shining light for the world to follow. The founding principles were very, very beautiful principles laid out, and we eventually did give the blacks what they should have been given from the word go from the beginning. But you had a bunch of good old boys from the South in different areas where they're redneckers, and they're the racist. So eventually, we did through the Civil Rights Act, and of all people, LBJ enacted that, and he was the biggest cheat on the election there ever was. You know, cheated the ballot box there in 1948. So against Coke Stevenson. So we're not much to say about that. But he did bring us a Civil Rights Act, and this was something that we just really need to continue, and so forth. It's not easy to see this thing, and so forth and so on. The ideas that are being taught from infancy by parents and schools and universities and colleges are not quite right. They're not quite right because the power is controlling much of the curriculum and so forth in our school system. The corporations have moved into the colleges and universities, you know, where you had a free speech movement. Now it's the political correct movement in Berkeley at the University of California. It's flip-flopped. Where it used to be where the liberal Democrats used to stand up for peace, now they've been subjugated by Obama in the last 8 years to taking feeding, see? The liberal Democrats now are working for the deep state. The deep state is against Trump. You need to come out of these traumatized conditions of delusion, is what I call it. We're all delusional by degree, but there comes a time when you have to awaken from this delusion and begin to see the world as it really is. And how do you do that? You do it through forgiveness. You've got to begin an action plan of forgiving yourself and others and making amends. The AA, the 12 steps in the AA plan works because it has three steps in there that are about making amends to people that you've transgressed against, see. And that's why it works, see. It works because it takes this off your conscience. It relieves your conscience. You begin to do the right thing. You say to people, forgive me for hurting you and doing you wrong in the past. I'm going a new method. I'm going on a new path here. A metanoia change. A change of direction. I'm experiencing an awakening up from this mesmerized condition, slave state, to something different. And that the term metanoia comes out of our religious teaching, see. And there again, we turn to other men through humanism versus humanitarianism. We look to men to solve our problems instead of looking to bend our knee to God and working with one another in a humanitarian way, see. We're placing men on the throne, see, of kingships instead of placing men and looking them eye to eye on a level of let's everyone is a king, no one wears a crown, I think is what someone said one time. This is what we need to proceed towards, is an area of forgiveness, understanding, a love for our neighbor. And our neighbor may be a Democrat, the neighbor may be a Republican, the neighbor may be a liberal, the neighbor may be a conservative. We must begin to understand that we're all become fools for these upper level manipulators. And these fools are no good. They don't care about our interests. They don't care about our families. Or they don't really care about America. They've been bought and paid for. It's a money-based system. They're becoming slaves to who they think they are through money and what that money can buy them. See, it's worthless when you come down to it. A man once told me, he looked at a new car and he said, 80% when you buy that new car, 80% of it is in your head, 20% on the ground, on the four wheels. And I was young and said, what do you mean? He said, look, it's the idea they sell you on the new car. You drive the car off the lot, you got massive depreciation the first year. So what are you talking about here? They're not good investments, see. But it's all in the head. And so what we've got to do is we've got to start observing our thoughts, see. To really know thyself, like the old Socratic and saying there, We need to begin to observe our thoughts. In observing our thoughts, we begin to understand that we have these very judgmental ideas a lot. We judge one another too severely. And in judging one another too severely, we continue in this delusional state. And we don't come out of it, see. And through forgiveness, you begin to establish a little bit at a time, day by day, hour by hour, second by second, a little bit more understanding and about yourself. And a third thing to work on is know thy world, see. And know thy world has to do on two levels. You must begin to try to appreciate and understand, but not in a judgmental way, human nature. Human nature has been the same for you. I don't think it's going to change appreciably. We may awaken a little bit at times, and then we'll fall back into an ignorant state, possibly of conditioning, see. But in this system of thinking, the thought itself can become like a thought prison, see. So the ideas that we've been acceptable to collectively make up our prison wall, see. And then in that prison wall, that worldview, then we hit back at other people with opposing worldviews that we don't like, or we think that, that worldview is wrong, mine is right, theirs is wrong. So I'm somebody and they're nobody. I remember that book, I'm Okay, You're Okay, see? Back in the Human Potential Movement period, there was a slew of books written, and that was one of them. But so, in a way, that I like that in a way, because it exudes non-judgment. Non-judgment, judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Now I'm getting into Scripture, see. But I know there's not a lot of people out there that are believers that and God and so forth. But I'll tell you what, you non-believers out there, if you're listening, and probably libertarians possibly or some, that forgiveness will help you too. See what I mean? And this thing of not becoming a God, that's helpful too, even though you may not be a non-believer. Because whenever we default to men, we get the weaknesses and the final decisions made by men, and they will fail us most of the time. There's only a few very, very exceptional men in the world that are true leaders, that are true diplomats, and understand and have been. And Dr. Wei Xing Zhang, or I should say, Wei Xing Zhang, who I've interviewed in the past, is one of those people spending 18 years in Chinese prisons. So he's the Wei Xing Zhang Foundation in D.C. Look that up. He's a man to listen to because he's been there and done it. And he stood firm. And my God, he's one of the finest men you'll ever want to even read or meet. But I want to thank you for listening tonight. And we'll be back next Saturday night, 7 to 9. And I hope you appreciate what we're doing. But thank you very much for all your thoughts and your prayers and your support over the years. And all we can do is hang in there, love our neighbor and ourselves. And Conversation with Tony Gling is next. Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Who's coming in with us this evening is Tony Gosley from all places, New Zealand. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosley.
Thanks very much for having me on, George. And I'm talking to you from a place called Queenstown, which is in the South Island of New Zealand. It's a really beautiful place, and there's quite a lot of American tourists here. Actually, most of the tourists seem to be either Koreans or Chinese.
Really?
But it is actually a beautiful place.
You're surrounded by Orientals, right?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't say totally surrounded, but there's loads going on here. We've had a really busy weekend in Queenstown with just about everything coming together at once. We had the St. Patrick's Day on Friday, plus we've had the Harley Davidson convention, plus a local food and wine festival going on all weekend, so it's been really busy here. Almost impossible to get anywhere to stay for the night apart from pitching a tent on the side of the lake. The weather's been absolutely fantastic, and really enjoying my stay and my holiday. But obviously, you know, just the fact that I'm having a holiday in New Zealand doesn't mean to say I've not been keeping track of what's been going on around the world.
Boy, I tell you what, Yeah, how much longer are you going to be down there? Another couple of weeks or what?
That's right, about another fortnight, spending a month over here. There's no point in coming to the opposite side of the world and only spending a week there. So, spending a whole, pretty much a whole of March here, then stopping in Singapore on the way home.
Okay, what do you think? Merkel was just here in Washington, D.C., Chancellor Merkel, and he was cool to her, President Trump was. He wasn't very friendly. Yeah.
Okay, so there are disputes, aren't there? Basically, I mean, the other thing is, I don't know whether this is genuine or not, but you've had this big dispute between Volkswagen and the US government, which I think is really just a kind of quid pro quo for the Germans not going along with US policy as regards to Russia and Syria. And when people don't do what they're told by the Israel and the United States and the UK, there's usually some price to pay, and I think that's what it's been.
Right.
That's why there's this frostiness there.
Yeah. He welcomed her, you know, with a handshake, but then later on the reporters were trying to get them to shake hands in the White House and stuff, but he's a little cool to her, you know, but she made a point at the press.
Well, I think you've got to be a little bit careful here because there is an attempt to, play up these differences.
Sure.
The other thing is when you're a world leader and the press pack starts to tell you do this, do that for the cameras, like, you know, you're at some kind of seaside holiday resort posing for the local photographer guy who's going to charge you the earth for your photographs in 10 minutes time. But, you know, that some of these world leaders don't necessarily just want to be maneuvered around and told exactly what they can do, especially when there's already been a photo opportunity with them just before, with them shaking hands. Do they want to really go through all that again? So I think we've got to be a bit careful about, jumping to conclusions about real relations.
Right.
Because, of course, it's like a Russian doll, ironically. You know, you've got what's really going on, and then you've got what the public are being told is very far away from that. I think we're living in an age today like Goebbels at Nazi Germany, where most of what we're getting is got half-truths poisoned with lies. I mean, most of what we're getting is basically true, but there are some enormous lies involved in that day after day after day. I mean, for example, this whole business of ISIS, you know, being some kind of enemy. Well, it's an enemy that people who are very close to our own governments, often funded by our taxpayer dollars and pounds, that are funding ISIS, you know, so, and controlling ISIS. So we're being led a merry dance that somehow ISIS is the enemy, when actually we're paying for that enemy, to create an enemy. If you remember all that time ago, gosh, I think it was John Stockwell. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, yes.
The CIA officer, one of the highest ranking officers ever to blow the whistle. And then he did his brilliant book called In Search of Enemies, about the CIA going around the world looking for people to pick fights with. Basically, that's what the British did as part of the British Empire. And it's the Americans that have taken on that mantle. Ever since the Second World War, really, the US has been trying to do the same sort of thing, but not in quite as subtle a way as the Brits used to do it, quite subtly in many ways, particularly with the propaganda. Obviously New Zealand here, there is actually quite good relations between the natives, the Maori, and have become the settlers. In fact, the Maoris here, one of the things I was finding out, George, is fascinating as you get chit-chatting with these old-timers, old-timer New Zealanders, down the pub and whatever, and in the bars, is that the Maoris have done amazing legal battles, and they've successfully won a lot of compensation now for the land that was stolen from them in many parts of New Zealand. And with that money, they have not been idle, a bit like some of the North American Indians have made an absolute fortune from their investments. Here, some of the biggest tourist attractions are actually Maori-owned. And so even though the people who are operating these Maori companies, foundations and trusts and things, are often, you know, white New Zealanders and people maybe been trained in London, New York, etc., chief executives, financial officers, etc., the the Maoris are actually the ones controlling the trusts and the charities that are making fantastic amounts of money out of the various tourist traps there are around here. So they've done a very good job, I think, in getting back at the settlers, getting, you know, back at the colonialists, and actually saying, well, look, we're going to be on a par with you financially, and yes, we'll share this land with you, but don't think that we're going to be some kind of underclass.
Right. The row about this wiretapping is continuing on. I interviewed Duncan Campbell yesterday, and he knows a lot about the GCHQ there in UK. And, you know, they came up with, a number of years ago at that Menwith station there, they came up with the idea of, why don't we just record everything? See what I mean? And that's basically what they've been doing. You know, they just record everything.
Well,
now,
it's,
you know,
true, but look, yeah, really what they want is, okay, let me just explain what I think they're doing with this. I mean, think, for example, with this call we're making now, this broadcast we're recording now.
Right.
Everything now is listened to in real time. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to add to everything, to the stream of things which are being listened to in real time. So they started off, I guess, with phone calls, listening to specifically targeted telephones.
Right.
Then, due to the digital exchanges, they became possible through the massive increases in bandwidth and computing power, memory and storage, that kind of thing, it became possible to listen to all phone calls so that you could, if you wanted to, go back through somebody's phone call history, you know, maybe even 4 or 5 years, listen to old phone calls that they'd made a long time ago. So they did that. And then what they've been doing ever since is to try and add and add and add to that ability to record people's lives, effectively. And this is ordinary people. This is not people who are terrorists. And what they're, the way they justify it to themselves, people like NSA and GCHQ, is that, oh, well, at some point, this information might be useful to us. So, but of course, what it does enable them to do is to target specific journalists, MPs, young, up-and-coming political activists, so that they can kind of squash political activism before it's even started. A little bit like in the Second World War, one of the big plans was to bomb the shipyards where the Nazis were building U-boats. And what the British planned to do was to bomb those places where even where the U-boats were being designed, so that they couldn't even get to the building them stage. And that's what they're doing, I think, with the public now, is that they're trying to disrupt political activism at very early levels, listening to all political activists, people that might be trying to change things for the better in the future, and targeting them with this mass surveillance. For example, with Google, every time you type into there,
right,
something,
right,
the NSA is reading that in real time. So if you type in something like NSA, immediately they're going to be interested in, like, what's this person looking for in the NSA. But it'll also be key specific individuals, so people who are very powerful behind the scenes, in the banking fraternities, in places like Goldman Sachs. If there are journalists who are looking up those individuals on Google, the NSA, Google will be feeding that information through in real time. So they'll say, right, this guy, 2 minutes ago, he Googled this, and he's now looking at that. Looks like he's putting an article together, X, Y, and Z. And they can start to actually have an operational arm to go in to disrupt that individual before they've even written the article, George. This is how crazy this is getting now.
I think you're right.
On top,
yeah,
of all that.
Yeah, you're right about that, Tony.
On top of all that.
Yeah.
We've got the revelations through the Vault 7 hacking is making it absolutely clear things that we suspected anyway. I mean, we did back the same year that he died a whole program about Michael Hastings and the way that he, it appeared, was killed. His car was hacked. There was a lot of evidence that it had been. I mean, he'd told his girlfriend, "My car is acting suspiciously," that same evening he died. There's also the film from the police camera of his car shooting past at 70 or 80 miles an hour, going, running a red light. And you can see that his brake lights are on. So he's got his foot jammed on the brake, but the car is still speeding along at 70, 80 miles an hour. And he, of course, was investigating John Brennan and looking at the CIA spying on congressmen, on senators in the United States, trying to disrupt certain things which might be coming down the pipeline, which the CIA didn't like through the political arm, the elected part of government, and also, of course, it does look as if, with the cooperation of Mercedes, because they would have needed that, that Brennan and Mercedes decided together, look, this guy, I'm afraid we're going to take him out. And Mercedes, well, it was very interesting the way, because he was driving a Mercedes just like Princess Diana, and also just like the chauffeur for Vladimir Putin, by the way, whose Mercedes veered across inexplicably right into the path of his car. So I think Mercedes really is a car that nobody should buy. And anyone that's got a modern Mercedes, anything built after about 2005 maybe, or maybe even around about 2000, should just get rid of their car. Because these things are dangerous. You know, obviously you can't stop someone hitting you head on, coming in the opposite direction. But you don't want to be in a car that starts doing things, you know, which you don't want it to be. But anyway, getting back to Michael Hastings, this is quite clear to me that, I mean, even the CIA even admitted that they can then use this ability to hack cars as a way to covertly assassinate people. And I think Michael Hastings was covertly assassinated. I think actually the guy is an absolute hero of journalism. He did a really good book as well called The Operators, which is all about how the military really just had a total disdain for the population, the ordinary members of the public, and the politicians that we elect, and they just get on and do what the hell they want anyway, and they have no respect at all for the people who are paying their wages. They have no respect for the country, countrymen and women of the countries which they're supposed to be serving. And they're just basically like overgrown teenagers playing with massive weapons, getting a kind of kick out of being the most macho on the scene. So this book, The Operators, is really, you know, people haven't come across that. Do have a read of it, Michael Hastings' book, because I think it's really for his journalism and for writing that book and exposing I think it was McChrystal that had to resign as a result. The guy who was in charge of the US troops in Afghanistan had to resign as a result of one of Michael Hastings' reports. That is, you know, this is the kind of military that we really need to weed out, not just in the United States, but obviously in the UK too. You know, we've got our own people in our military. We used to call, I don't know if you've heard the term before, the green slime, George.
The green slime
were and are these are the guys in military intelligence that go in and they basically pretend to be the other side. So they'll be involved in all sorts of, like, counter-gang operations where they'll go in and set up groups which are supposed to be fighting them, you know, so they are trying to basically play both sides of the chessboard, and so they'll be killing their own people in order to gain some kind of propaganda advantage in one way or another, maybe to get more money. To fight the war, to actually get the war going in a more trenchant fashion, so that they can commit more troops to a particular war zone. The green slime, I mean, we have one guy, particularly Brigadier Gordon Kerr in Northern Ireland, who was doing this the whole time, something called the Force Research Unit. And I think in many ways, Northern Ireland was a kind of model for the sorts of sectarian conflicts we're seeing in the Middle East, particularly the Middle East, you know, this sort of Catholic-Protestant divide, which wasn't really a Catholic-Protestant, it was a Unionist-Nationalist or Loyalist-Republican divide, to be more accurate, a Loyalist-Republican divide, which wasn't religious, it was cultural, and it was part of the two different cultures. That was exactly what we've seen throughout the Middle East, particularly with the sort of split between the Shia and the Sunnis. You know, these, again, a cultural divide, which is characterized as some sort of religious divide, the idea being to sort of win a propaganda victory and tell everyone, well, this religion is complete rubbish. Obviously, these people are crazy. They're just killing each other. The fact of the matter is, you know, Northern Ireland was never really about religion. It was about the two cultures, the Republican culture, which is like unity with Southern Ireland, and the Unionist culture, which was very much Masonic, Orange Order, and very, very loyal to the British Crown in a fanatical, fundamentalist fashion. Right. So these weren't ordinary religious factions. They're crazy religious factions, fake religions, a bit like ISIS or like the Puritans in the English Civil War, who were completely like fanatical, crazed, swivel-eyed Protestants, you know, who were just completely off, out of control. So that's what I think we're dealing with now, is the sort of thing that was trained for in Northern Ireland first, George. We're seeing that happen all over the Middle East now with the factional infighting, which has been deliberately created.
Right. Roger Stone got T-boned here the other day down in Florida. And then the truck driver that hit him ran off with, and it was a hit and run. So,
sorry, who did?
Roger Stone got T-boned down in Florida, and got on his car on the driver's side. A truck hit him right on the side of his car when he was driving in Florida a few days ago, about a week ago.
Well, I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, and so they're out there working. You know, he got polonium poisoned, we think, you know, several months ago. So, and now we got T-boned by some truck driver that ran off, you know, hit and run. So, what you said, you know, about Hastings.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, we were on to Hastings from the beginning, but we couldn't prove it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, now with the confirmation.
That's right, yeah. Well, I think the thing is there is always the evidence. I mean, the evidence in the Hastings right from the start was Mercedes refused to answer any questions. Okay. That's number one. That is evidence.
Right.
If the Mercedes don't cooperate with you, you have to say, what the hell are they doing? Do they not want, why aren't they cooperating? You've got to cooperate. There's someone's just died in one of your cars. Why aren't you cooperating? Number one. Number two is your red light, the brake light on his car rammed on. What's going on there? Number three, him saying to his girlfriend, something funny going on with my car, please can I borrow yours? And she said, unfortunately, no, because my car's going in for a service tomorrow. Anyway, so I'm going to need it, you know, to take it there and back. So you can't borrow my car. There are other circumstantial things, like, you know, in that nobody is in their right mind is going to be doing 70, 80 miles an hour. Another piece of evidence before anything from the CIA leaks was also that the engine appeared to explode before the car actually hit the tree. So, you know, there were quite a lot of indications that this was an assassination of a journalist, a murder of a journalist, you know, right at the very beginning.
Right. It was highly suspicious from the very, very beginning. But this Roger Stone thing just, you know, about a week ago, it shook him up. He didn't go to the hospital, and he went ahead and carried on his reporting and, you know, on the radio that he has and everything. But, you know, it's getting...
Well, we had the Gary Webb, the case of Gary Webb as well, didn't we, of course, a few years ago, reporting on the Iran-Contra.
Right, right. Gary Webb had been fired by the San Jose Mercury, and he had broken the drug dealing in South L.A., and they didn't want to hear it. They you know, the CIA evidently started crack down there or something, crack, you know, epidemic.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you've got an arrogant elite who are criminals, effectively, an organized crime, running the show.
Exactly.
And I suppose what you could say is we should be a bit worried in a way that these guys, as it looks like a lot of their plans are hitting brick walls in Syria, Ukraine and elsewhere, that we should place the empire on suicide watch. You know, because these people are getting, you know, to the point where they may do something really crazy because they're starting to be found out. They're starting to show out. And we all know that that's what these sort of people do. You know, once it looks as if the spotlight's starting to turn on them, rather than them being able to just run things. So everything they do starts to not work because so many people know what they're up to. Then there's a really good article, actually, along those lines. Placed the empire on suicide watch on the Saker website.
My gosh.
I don't know if you know the Saker. He's this guy that used to work as a military advisor for the United Nations. And I interviewed him over Christmas time. I was just really impressed with his analysis of the global affairs. One of the things, for example, he's done for me, which is to clarify for me, is really to affirm what I suppose I kind of assumed anyway, which is that you've got 80% of the effort of the military now going into psychological warfare as part of, you know, fighting other countries, trying to get their way, warfare now, 80% of it is psychological. So that's massive amounts of resources put into the mainstream media, mainly.
Right.
Lies, manipulation of those sorts. And then 15% is going into economic warfare, and that leaves only 5% for real fighting. So, you know, for actual guns and weapons and things like that, because they're realizing that they're starting to come up against these various brick walls, which they can't fight. And if they do fight the little guys, then the people at home have got no confidence in them. So they have to use psychological tactics instead. And this is where we're going with, you know, with Goebbels, you know, the Goebbels world, because he was one of the main operators in Nazi Germany, Joseph Goebbels. I mean, there are others like Goering who weren't, you know, actually were pretty disgusted with what Hitler was doing, particularly with the extermination of the Jews. He wasn't in favor of that. In fact, he kept some very close Jewish friends and looked after them, you know. But Goebbels was obsessed with this thing about destroying Jews, as was, of course, Himmler, Eichmann, and people like that, you know. So there were various factions in Nazi Germany, and I think, in a way, you know, I find it fascinating to study Nazi Germany. I still do read stuff on it, you know, because, in a way, what was happening there was, in the 1930s, late 30s and 40s, what we saw was our opposition, George, you know, this is basically the bad people of this world who decided that they're going to steal a march on everyone else by being a bunch of crooks and criminals. But what they did is they showed out in a massive way, like I think they've never done before, and they've certainly ever since been trying to do everything they can, possibly hidden, but you could see them very, very clearly. It was almost like a beast rising above the surface of the sea. Hey, let's get a good look at this thing before it disappears again, you know. So I'm not studying Nazi Germany from a mawkish point of view, but because I think it tells us so much about what's going on today.
Right. After that assassination, the last one against Hitler, Goebbels took over command. They were trying to take over his opposition command of Berlin, but Goebbels stopped the revolution from happening right after Hitler was injured, and actually put down the revolution that was the military coup that was underway, from what my readings. So Goebbels did save.
No, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, he did, and there were key.
Yeah, he was.
There were key elements and people that he was still talking to. He was still talking to Hitler, see? They didn't cut off that communication to him, and that sort of saved Hitler's regime temporarily, you know. But,
Yeah, well, in the end, it was inevitable, and everybody knew that, but
yes,
there were a few people that fought to the end, weren't there, you know. And you're right, Goebbels was a key guy at the time, and the propaganda ministry was, you know, very, very important in, first of all, in demonizing the Jews. You know, this is one thing which is, you know, if you look at it, you couldn't make it up, where certain Jews who were very rich and powerful were kind of considered to be not Jews, and all the rest were rounded up in concentration camps and put in forced labor and starved, etc., etc.
Right.
But mainly it's because there are different sorts of Jews, just as there are different sorts of Christians. And ones who were very steeped in the Old Testament rabbinic tradition, those were the ones that Goebbels wanted dead. You know, he wanted it, that part of the main operation of what Nazi Germany was about, that a lot of people miss this, was really just to exterminate in Europe any kind of vestige of an understanding of Old Testament law, really, the way that you know, sort of Old Testament morality. That's what the Jewish people had across Europe, and that's what the Nazis wanted to scrub out, because the Nazi Empire really was a pagan empire, with Hitler as God and with Himmler as his prophet, you know, so he's kind of high priest guy, in charge of the SS. So that was where you've got this kind of religious element. Really, it was a religion. Nazism was a sort of twisted religion. But look, let's get back to some of the stuff that's been going on this week, because there's been so much happening. We've got these two massive attacks in Syria, and I'm starting to look upon this as a kind of there's been a Russian victory, really, in a way, in Aleppo just before Christmas. There's now the clearing out of Mosul, for example. ISIS seems to be really on the back foot in Syria. But what is happening is we're getting horrendous bomb attacks by, you know, big inverted commas, by ISIS. You had on the Wednesday, I think it was, double bombings in Damascus with 30 or so people killed at the courthouse, and a restaurant, 20 plus people killed in a restaurant. Now, this is supposed to be suicide bombings, George, and you know what? Nobody needs to be a suicide bomber in a restaurant. If you're going to kill somebody in a restaurant, you don't need to run in and blow yourself up. You just leave a bag and walk out,
right,
and then you press the button and the bomb goes off. There's absolutely no need for any kind of suicide bombing, either in a courthouse or in a restaurant. This whole thing stinks to me, stinks to high heaven. If it's a hard target, if it's a military target, perhaps someone will be, you might decide you want a suicide bombing. But you don't need to do that in a restaurant. You know, absolutely insane. And the press never questioned this. And, of course, there was back in the 11th of March, there were 46 Iraqis killed in a cemetery. Again, supposedly a suicide bombing in a cemetery. So you don't need a suicide bombing, a bomber, in a cemetery. You just leave a bomb and walk away and blow it up. That's what you would do if you were a real terrorist. But I don't believe these people are real terrorists, George. Also, of course, the day after there was the mosque bombing, the US Air Force apparently saying that they didn't bomb the mosque. They bombed the religious school next door. But actually, the pictures on the ground show that the bomb did go through the religious school, destroyed the roof, and went into the mosque next door. And I'm not sure how many people were killed in that. I think it's about 35 were killed in a mosque. Now, just a minute. If, say, for example, the Iranian Air Force were to come and bomb a church in Albuquerque, put a bomb through the window and blow everybody up inside, what do you think would be the Western press's reaction to that?
Well, I don't know. What would you say?
Well, they go nuts. They go nuts.
Yeah.
They go nuts. You can't do this. What are they doing? They're bombing funerals. They're bombing marriages.
Yeah.
They're bombing wedding ceremonies. They're bombing religious services. This is quite a deliberate tactic, I think, in order to destroy, attempt to, first of all, to commit horrific war crimes, and secondly, to attack the morale of the people.
Right.
And they're thinking, well, if these people will kill us in the mosque, in the church, in the synagogue, you know, and our places of worship, if they'll just blow us up, then we can't go to mosque. We're sitting there praying to our God, and then they're blowing us to pieces while we're doing that. This really is, I don't think there was even deliberate, the Nazis deliberately targeting, you know, their V1 bombs or V2 bombs or, you know, 100 bomber bombing raids, deliberately targeting cathedrals, you know, during the Second World War.
Right.
But that's what's happening now, George. You know, the religious services are basically now a place where people are fearing for their lives in Syria. Am I going to be blown to bits?
Well, it has the characteristics of Manchurian Candidate's programmed people, then, see? But, you know, some of those fanatical Muslims will do that anyway.
Some of these Muslims will do that, I'm quite sure. And, you know, there are probably Christians and Jews that would do the same, die for their faith or whatever. But the point being here is, I think what's happening is individuals have got bombs on them. Maybe they don't even know that it's a bomb on them. So it could be a backpack they've been told to go in somewhere.
Yeah, it could be set up. That's true. That could be going on. Thank you for listening to our program tonight. We want to thank profusely each and every one of you. And God bless America. God bless each and every one of you. Good night. Thank you.